You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, we learn about Milwaukee's socialist history and the long-term conservative reaction that still shapes politics to this day.
First, swearing is a part of everyday life. Whether you swear a lot yourself or just hear it in TV, movies, daily life, it can be hard to avoid.
What is considered swearing has changed over time. Some words that used to be pretty strong stuff barely get a reaction anymore. And others have come out of nowhere to become the most shocking words in our language.
But even if the specifics have changed, it is still true that there are some words that are not considered polite or acceptable in many or most situations. And even in a country that holds free speech dear, some words can get you in trouble, or if, say, you're a radio station, it can bring you some pretty stiff fines.
Benjamin Bergen says that swear words are not only worthy of study, but are an important key to understanding language and culture. He's a professor of cognitive science at the University of California, San Diego. His new book is What the F? What Swearing Reveals About Our Language, Our Brains, and Ourselves. Ben, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much.
So you called your book a love letter to profanity. Why do you think swearing is worthy of your research?
Well, my research is focusing on how language is manifested in the brain, what it can tell us about how we communicate, how we socialize, how we evolved. And profanity is a particular class of language that most clearly allows us to communicate our strongest emotions to other people and evokes the strongest emotions in other people. And as a result, it just works differently from the rest of language. And for that reason, it affords us windows into the different dimensions of what it is to be human that other language just doesn't.
Yeah, and an amazing thing there is that a different part of our brain handles a lot of the swearing than the rest of our language. Like, say, to choose a random example, when my egg sandwich blew up yesterday and shot yolk everywhere, something came out, you know, some words, and that was like not the same part of my brain that's talking to you right now.
Exactly. We have an evolutionarily new system for producing language rationally, intentionally. I'm using it right now. You were just using it. It lives on usually in the left side of the brain in most people and on the surface of the cerebral cortex. That's the new part of the brain that humans have developed to do all kinds of abstract stuff like math and language. But this spontaneous profanity that your egg salad sandwich evoked was driven by a different part of the brain, a much older part that lives deep in the center and that we share with other animals, that is responsible for communicative vocalizations that other animals use to express fear or stress, anxiety, and so on. And we use these two different systems for different purposes, for rationally expressing our thoughts or for expressing our hot emotional states.
And you break down into four categories, swear words and offensive language. You know, we, of course, don't want to run afoul of the FCC, so we're going to keep it very clean and not say the words, use shorthand to describe them. But, you know, they break down into all of these different categories: religious profanity, words that describe various bodily functions, sex and slurs about groups of people. Why are those the worst things, you know, we can say?
It's true that when you do a survey of the languages of the world, profanity tends to come from those four places. And it seems to be because we have taboos about those specific things. I mean, we have taboos about bodily functions. That's why we wall off bathrooms inside of houses. We have taboos about religious concepts. We have taboos about other groups of people, particularly people that we marginalize and dehumanize through slurs. And the taboos seem to transfer over the course of cultural history from the concept of the activity that you perform in a bathroom, for example, to the words that describe that function.
And is there something that makes a good and effective swear word in terms of how it's structured and the letters in it, the sounds in it?
Well, we have this idea that bad words tend to have four letters in English. And that's true, actually. If you look at the statistics, they're more likely to have four letters than you'd expect by chance. But the real reason for that has to do not with the spelling, but with the sounds of the words. In English, most of our worst words, you can think about your favorite four-letter words, have the same sound structure. They're one syllable long, and they end with one or more consonants. And it's in particular these hard stop consonants like k and t and p. These sounds, we seem to have decided as English speakers make a word sound particularly dirty. And so when English speakers make up new profane words, they tend to follow this pattern, whether it's when they're making up, you know, words in a fictitious language for television or movies, or when they hear new words, they're more likely to think that they're profane if they have that sound pattern.
And we're talking with Benjamin Bergen. He's a professor of cognitive science at the University of California, San Diego, where he directs the Language and Cognition Laboratory. He has come out with a new book, What the F? What Swearing Reveals About Our Language, Our Brains, and Ourselves. And I want to get to some audio here. Benjamin, you know, it's pretty clear what we're getting at, but it's from Battlestar Galactica, where they invented a word to get around sensors. Let's take a listen.
You're fracking kidding me.
Oh, frack me.
Frack the odds.
Frack me.
If all our vipers are fracking around,
frack!
Frack you! There are so fracking many.
Yeah? Frack's that.
Oh, frack off.
It's pretty clear what frack means. Does it have the same power as an actual recognized swear word?
Yeah, those are examples of exactly the same pattern of making these words that have the same sound structure. And because it has the same sound structure, it will have a little bit of the same impact. But most of the impact that real profanity has comes from a lifelong a history of training. You know, as young children, we're told that these are the words that we can't say in public or we'll be punished, that shouldn't be said around particular people because they might find them offensive. And we learn those lessons early on from age one or two, and we internalize them. And that's why we find those particular words, not frack, but the other ones, so compelling. And that's why our bodies react to them physiologically in this unique way.
And apologies to our Cylon listeners for that display there. Benjamin, let's talk about context a little, because the same word, if I hear it with friends out and about, it'll just roll over me. Hearing that word in a church or on the radio, hopefully that doesn't happen, I will definitely be very shocked by that. How much does context matter when it comes to swearing?
Well, context is everything, of course. And this is what we learn from early in childhood. We learn that the same adults who are willing to use these words when a preferred football team loses a game or when a preferred football team wins a game in an informal setting will refuse to use them in exactly the sort of formal context that you describe. So a large part of learning, not just about profanity, but about language and social action in general, is learning what the invisible social rules are for when we can and when we can't do particular things.
And Benjamin, who decides what's considered a swear word? When does a swear word become a swear word?
Yeah, well, it's really complicated. There aren't any lists. So the FCC governs the fines that could be assigned to your radio station if we were to slip up here, but they never sent you a list of the, you know, these are the 18 words that you can't say, and they don't tell you what hours you can't say them. So we don't actually know. It seems to be something that's agreed upon more or less by bodies that have power, but there's not really any official rule book that tells you what words are bad when. It seems to be more of a zeitgeist than anything else.
We're talking with Benjamin Bergen about swearing and what we can learn about ourselves by studying it. His most recent book is What the F? What Swearing Reveals About Our Language, Our Brains, and Ourselves.
And we want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. Is swearing part of your everyday vocabulary? When and where do you do it? Or do you do it rarely, maybe even never? Where do you think swear words get their power from? Do you have questions for our guest about his research? Call 800-642-1234. Keep it clean or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll pick up that conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're talking about swearing and what it tells us about our language, our culture, and even how our brains work. And we hope you'll join in by calling 800-642-1234. Why do you think swear words are so powerful? Do you feel yourself react when you hear someone swear? And what lessons did you get growing up about swearing? And what have you passed down to your own kids? Call 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Benjamin Bergen is with us. He's a professor of cognitive science at the University of California, San Diego. His new book is What the F? What Swearing Reveals About Our Language, Our Brains, and Ourselves. And Ben, let's talk about kids. You know, as a parent, I try to clean up my act when the kids, especially when they were little, try to protect them from it. Is hearing swearing bad for kids?
Yeah, well, I'm a parent too, so I worry about this a lot as well. You know, kids have lots of things that they can be exposed to that will be really harmful. And we know about these things. Foremost among them is verbal abuse. And, you know, it's not a laughing matter at all. There are lots of ways that kids can be harmed by language, whether they're told that they're worthless, whether they're threatened, and so on. And this can be accompanied by profanity, but it very often is not. And there's no evidence that including profanity in verbal abuse makes it any worse. So verbal abuse, clearly bad. Also clearly harmful is slurs. So these terms that are derogatory towards a person based on some social identity that they have, race, ethnicity, sex, sexual identity, and so on. Kids who are called by, for example, homophobic slurs throughout middle school report increases in depression, anxiety, and feelings of separation from their school. So these things are clearly harmful. But as for the sort of fleeting expletive that makes its way out when your sandwich explodes or when someone cuts you off in traffic or when you step on a piece of Lego in bare feet late at night. Those things haven't ever been demonstrated to cause harm to kids. And so in general, what we can say is that it's really not about the words specifically that you choose, but the message that you're conveying, the intent that you are using those words for, that can really be harmful for children.
Well, that's a relief. We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234 with Kathy on the line in Germantown. Kathy, hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I heard this expert call in the morning with Joy a couple weeks ago and was quite intrigued. And the short story I wanted to talk about actually has to do with my children. Is when my daughter, who's 12 now, was about 3, she used the non-PG version of gosh darn it in somewhat context-appropriate times. And I finally had a conversation with her one time and said, you know, This is not a little child word. These are adult words. And so she took it to heart because, evidenced by a few days later, she dropped something or in a, fell or something. And she announced to all of us, I not say gosh darn it. I not say that. and since then she, you know, will only use euphemisms for any of those, adult words that she hears.
Kathy, thank you so much. I have an almost identical story with maybe an even worse word with one of my kids. Ben, is that a good way to approach it with kids, just to, you know, not to give the word too much power, just to explain that context, as you were talking about earlier?
Yeah, kids are really good about learning context, right? They're good at learning, I mean, starting at around that same age of 2 or 3, they're learning when they're potty trained that there are certain places that you do these things and other places, actually most of the rest of the world, where you don't do these things. And they can understand that. And they understand it with language. When their kids are growing up bilingual, they learn that there's one language that they use in the home and another language that they learn at school. So context is something that they're really sensitive to. And I think you're exactly right. The worst thing you can do is to react strongly, because that's what they learn is a way that they can have control over their environment. You know, if you react strongly, then they're going to realize, oh, if I use this word, I'm going to get out of putting on my shoes or washing my hands or putting down my toys, because now I'm going to orient to a different type of thing. I can control what mom and dad are doing. Allowing them to have that power over you is a way to show them that these words are powerful. But by contrast, by really mentoring them in the social nuances of how these words work in the world, that's a way to get on the same page with them and show them that you actually care about them succeeding.
Well, let's go to another caller, Darren from Appleton. Hi, Darren.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What do you have to say?
Well, as I deal with this every day, the students who use the swear words in their day, they use them, they're just words. Their arguments are they are just words until they learn the meaning. And you have to teach them the meaning of those words for them not to use them. And it's what she was just talking about. It's the power that you give those words, and they have to learn that power.
And so, Benjamin, do we, sometimes just use these swear words without really understanding their meaning and, you know, really what they can do, especially slurs?
Oh, there's no doubt. You know, you look at the sort of sex-based profanity that we have a lot of in English. Most kids who are using these words in kindergarten, for example, they have no idea. They couldn't possibly understand the complexities of the world that they're evoking with these words. And one thing that this caller's comment brings up is that these words really are always in a state of change. You know, when I was growing up, I'm 40 now. When I was growing up, the word sucks wasn't a particularly offensive thing to say on the playground, right? This sucks, that sucks. And nowadays, you see it on absolutely every television station and radio station. My parents, however, thought that this was an amazingly offensive word, right? They couldn't possibly imagine allowing this in the house. And this is a consequence of changes in the way that these words are used. Younger kids are using words that a previous generation found very offensive, and this generation's kids will probably find a whole new class of offensive words that they don't think are that bad.
We're talking with Benjamin Bergen, who's a professor of cognitive science at the University of California, San Diego. He's out with a new book, What the F, What Swearing Reveals About Our Language, Our Brains, and Ourselves. I want to ask you, Benjamin, have you found an upside at all to swearing? Are there, you know, any hidden health benefits credited to profanity?
People say that they use it for a lot of reasons. One is for cathartic reasons. So if you're particularly angry or frustrated, stressed out, anxious, then you might use profanity to alleviate those experiences. There's not a lot of great evidence on that, but there is evidence on one particular use, which is to alleviate pain. There have been a couple of studies out of the UK showing that if you have people do something painful, you have them immerse their hand in nearly freezing water, and have them swear or not swear while they're doing it. The people who are told to swear can hold their hand in nearly twice as long, and they report that it hurts less. And this really comports with, I think, how a lot of people use profanity. You know, you slam your thumb in the door, or childbirth is another clear example where there's a lot of profanity. I think you find that many people use it to distract or to suppress from an experience of pain. And there's some evidence that that works.
Therapeutic swearing. Interesting. We'll go back to our callers now. Alyssa is on the line in Madison. Alyssa, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is a really interesting show. I just wanted to share that I grew up in a family that didn't use a lot of profanity, but I started to use more as I got older, and I really found it a way to, like, establish trust with friends and be myself.
Alyssa, was it weird for you coming from a family that didn't swear much when you first encountered swearing in, I don't know, middle school or something?
Yeah, I think so. It felt like a taboo, and then I gradually incorporated more of it into my vocabulary, and like I said, it just became a way to sort of have more relaxed, authentic conversations.
Interesting. Alyssa, thanks for that call. Ben, a marker of solidarity. We feel comfortable enough with each other to take away the formal rules and swear if we want to.
Yeah, people report this all the time. In workplaces, for example, stockbrokers report swearing all the time. People in the military report swearing all the time. Oftentimes, people in high-stress situations where relying on each other and having an informal relationship is thought to be valuable. I mean, also in comedy, right? There's a lot of swearing in comedy in large part because breaking down those social mores, those social expectations, is a way to say, hey, we're free here to speak openly and to be honest with one another.
And I want to ask you about bleeping. The TV show Arrested Development made it into an art form. Let's take a listen.
And please refrain from discussing or engaging in any sort of inter-office or or finger or sting or even even though so many people in this office are begging for it.
So, you know, bleeping is often used to stay on the right side, of course, of the FCC, but it, you know, doesn't it in some ways make offensive language more powerful since it is being assumed, implied? What do you think?
Right. Well, it's a way of staying within the letter of the law, but it's pretty counterproductive, right? Because in fact, everyone knows that there are bad words that are happening there. There's actually some empirical work. When you bleep profane words out, people think that there's actually more profanity in that movie than if there were you just presented the actual word. So it's a signal that these words are far too powerful for your feeble minds to process them. So instead, we're going to protect you from these words, and it's a way to increase the, as you said, the social power of the words.
A couple of callers wondering about illnesses, brain conditions that make people use more swear words or maybe almost exclusively swear words. What does that tell us about our brains?
Thinking about Tourette syndrome, probably. Mm-hmm. Under certain, and also Alzheimer's as well as some other conditions, there are certain conditions of the brain where people have trouble inhibiting profanity. These are usually diseases that affect a particular part of the brain, this very old part of the brain that's responsible for spontaneous profanity, in particular the basal ganglia, which is just a system that suppresses actions that you think are inappropriate when you're having a strong emotional experience. And people with Tourette syndrome, who only about 10% of them actually have this condition where they produce uncontrollable profanity, have trouble with their basal ganglia. So when they're experiencing stress or anxiety or anger, fear, frustration, they can't suppress these most taboo words of the language.
And Ben, briefly, a next step in studying swearing?
Well, I think something that I hinted at a little bit earlier, I'd like to explore the cathartic effects of profanity, if any. So when you're about to, say, go on a public radio show and you're feeling a little bit stressed out about it, does it help to mutter some profanities under your breath? Are you less likely to mess up your wording? That's the type of thing that we're exploring in my lab right now.
Well, Ben, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your research.
It's been my pleasure.
That's Benjamin Bergen. He's a professor of cognitive science at the University of California, San Diego, where he directs the Language and Cognition Laboratory. His most recent book is called What the F? What Swearing Reveals About Our Language, Our Brains, and Ourselves. You can share, perhaps in a cleaned-up format, your thoughts on swearing, where it's appropriate, if ever. You can do that over at the Central Time Facebook page. A program that helps students with behavioral problems is showing a marked drop in suspensions at several Milwaukee alternative schools. Last year, more than 90% of students in the PeaceWorks program decreased their suspensions compared to their previous school. More than three-quarters of those students had no suspensions at all after a year in the program.
Marquette University's Center for Peacemaking developed the PeaceWorks curriculum. Pam Stoller is the coordinator of PeaceWorks, and she joins us now. Pam, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much.
Well, lay out the program for us. How does the program work? Can you walk us through it?
Sure. So the PeaceWorks program is a nonviolence education program. We work in both public and parochial schools, but specifically for the MPS behavioral reassignment schools that we're talking about today, we work with small groups of students and teach a curriculum weekly that focuses on different skills to help them develop conflict resolution and in nonviolence education, a repertoire for them to be able to use those skills.
And what are some of these specific skills that you're talking about, and how are they taking them to their world? How are they taking them home with them?
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things to talk about, actually. So our curriculum includes, we have a different focus every week. So we start with the practice of gratitude, and we talk about the brain science behind that and why that's important. We help them with anger management techniques. We work on positive communication and different skills that they can use for that. And It's always every year, you know, my heart is full when kids come in and say, hey, I used that positive communication thing we learned with my mom and we didn't argue. You know, we actually talked. Or there was one student that always stands out to me. We do a lesson on grounding techniques. So that's where we teach them different skills that they can do when they're in that moment of really high emotion. So it's some mindfulness and breathing. And one of the things that we do is they make what's called a grounding stone. And they write a word on it, and it's a stone that they can keep with them. And they write a word on it that helps them to settle. And one of our students came back to school one day and told us a story about how he was about to get into, he was having a verbal altercation out on the street with some other boys. And he was about to get in a fight, and his stone was in his pocket. And he held on to it, and what he had written on it was the word future. And he said, I thought about my future, and I just walked away.
Mm. And you're seeing suspensions going down pretty dramatically for the students who are in PeaceWorks. Can you talk a little bit about these suspension rates?
Yeah, we really have seen a marked decrease in suspensions. And I think a lot of it is kids having a chance to learn these skills and practice them, and a place to go to talk about the challenges that they face and be supported. And another really important aspect of this is MPS and their support of programs like this. I attended an MPS in-service one day, and I was so impressed with the presenter. The example she used is, when kids can't read, we teach them. When kids can't do math, we teach them. When kids can't behave, we've suspended them. And MPS is really working on changing that traditional model, mm-hmm. and saying, we need to step in and help support students. No kid wants to get suspended. And so to help them to find alternatives and the skills to manage their behaviors. So it's really been a push, and we're so proud to be a part of that.
We're talking with Pam Stoller. She coordinates the PeaceWorks program, and that comes from the Center for Peacemaking at Marquette University. This program being used in Milwaukee public schools and some parochial schools as well. Pam, when you bring these students together in these small groups, several students, four students at a time, and you're really learning who they are as individuals, what do you find that they're really struggling with that, you know, could be at the center of these behavioral issues?
Yeah, I think there are several factors that come up a lot, and the kids are really open and honest about the challenges they face. I think a lot of it is this real lack of skills that comes from not seeing these skills modeled for them a lot of times in their neighborhoods and you know, in the people that surround them. So a lot of things that sometimes I might take for granted are new to them, and that's part of the learning. And another thing that the students talk about a lot is a lack of role models for them, and they have a real yearning to have role models, but also to be role models. We have our students talk all the time about having younger brothers and sisters and wanting to for them to be able to look up to them and wanting to be that person for them. And so you know, that's one thing that we try to do is give them not only the skills but also the confidence to know that they can be that person.
And when you teach them something like gratitude or empathy, these aren't things that are tangible. How do you know that they're getting it, that they're developing these skills, and they're really using them?
Yeah, it's interesting. I'll use those two examples because those are such great ones. One thing that we do in our lessons with kids is every time we meet, they have a gratitude journal, and they write down three things that they're grateful for. And it's so fascinating to see the growth in that. In the beginning, a lot of kids will say, you know, nothing, or they almost always will identify, I woke up this morning, you know, I'm not dead. So that's something to be grateful for. And sometimes that's where it stops. And inevitably, by the end of the semester or the year that we work with them, they're coming up with, you know, five or six or seven things and very diverse things and new things. They challenge themselves to come up with new things every time. So we see that growth sort of just happening in front of us. And empathy is such a great one. It's one of my favorite things to talk about, and we bring it up again and again. And another just a really typical student example is where students will come to us and say, you know, about it, maybe a particular teacher, you know, Mr. A seems like something's really going on with him today. Sometimes I would get mad about that, but I thought maybe he's got something going on at home, so I kind of just let it go. You know, so it's that language and those behaviors that really just show us that these are becoming a part of who they are.
And now, Pam, that you've been working with this program for several years, what have these students taught you? How have you been changed?
That is probably one of the most powerful things about the program for me, is how much they have impacted our life, our entire team. And I think the thing that stands out to me the most is that we have this wealth of youth in our city that is bright and funny and hopeful. And one thing that surprised me so much was I expected them to say, you know, when we talk about goals in their future, well, I want to get out, you know, I want to go to college and go make money and go live somewhere else. Because a lot of times their perceptions of Milwaukee can be really negative. And it really is just the opposite for so many of our kids. They say, I want to graduate and go to college, and then I want to come back. And I want to come back to my neighborhood, and I want to make things better, and I want to start a business here, and I want to give people jobs. And I don't know, you know, working with them and seeing that that's their intention in life, and that's their intention in our city and in our world, is really life-changing.
We're talking to Pam Stoller. She's the coordinator of Marquette University's PeaceWorks program that operates in several of Milwaukee's alternative schools to help students with behavioral problems return to traditional schools.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced a program like PeaceWorks as a teacher, a student, a parent that's made an impact on you, on your family? Are you a teacher? Do you see a need for programs like this, not just discipline, but behavior education? Have you seen other ways to fix behavioral problems in teens, in schools? You can add your voice to the conversation now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking to Pam Stoller. She coordinates the PeaceWorks program through Marquette University's Center for Peacemaking, working to help teens using alternative schools in the Milwaukee area to resolve their conflicts, learn behavior techniques that resolve conflicts and avoid suspensions.
You can join in at 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. If you're a teacher, a parent, or a teen yourself, what questions do you have about this PeaceWorks program, and does a program like PeaceWorks make sense in schools? Call 800-642-1234. Pam, you have this interesting motto I've read. You say that peaceful schools mean a peaceful city. Can you kind of take me through what that means for you?
Yeah. You know, I'm going to back that up even an extra step. Because we start out with the kids saying peaceful minds make a peaceful school, and then that translates into peaceful schools making a peaceful city, and peaceful cities make a peaceful world. So it really is that ripple effect, and where we start is with the students in their own minds and hearts. But schools are just such, we have such a privilege in our country that all of our youth attends school. We have our entire society in schools where we can help them and give them the tools that they need to sort of make our society what we hope for it to be. And I think that it becomes a lost opportunity if we don't use that to do some socio-emotional education and help them to really achieve what they want, not only academically, but both in the things that make life valuable, personal relationships and just basic well-being. And then that translates, of course, you know, that, again, ripple effect translates out to everyone that they touch.
And I understand you wrote this curriculum. Did you look to other programs around the country to base it off of, or did anything inspire you from elsewhere as you put this curriculum together for PeaceWorks?
Yeah, we had a PeaceWorks curriculum. PeaceWorks has been around for about 9 years now, running in different schools in both Chicago and Milwaukee. And so we had a basic curriculum, but we do still use that curriculum. But when we went to the MPS behavioral reassignment schools, we really found that we had to take a step back. It wasn't so much at that point about leadership and being a peacemaker in the world as it was, how do I just get through my day? You know, how do I get through my day without fighting with someone or losing my temper or feeling bad inside? So my background is as both a teacher and a counselor.
Mm-hmm.
So I really drew on those things and what I've learned about you know, cognitive restructuring and different emotional learning. And also just learning from the kids. This curriculum has been a work in progress in that things will come up for the kids, and then we say, "Oh, we need to write a lesson on this." Like they're asking for this skill now.
And what are some of those skills that they have asked for that they want to learn?
Yeah, we have a really interesting lesson which came directly from the kids. We would talk about positive communication and how to get along with people. And they would come to us and say, you know, there are some people in my life that I need to deal with, but I don't really want to have a relationship with them. You know, they're not people that are going to be healthy for me in my life, but I can't fight with them all the time either. But they're really hard to get along with. So we have a lesson called Dealing with Difficult People, in which I, you know, sort of did my research and drew on sources to figure out, how do you deal with somebody that just does not want to get along with you? And it's one of their favorite lessons because it gives them some language to use with people when you don't want to engage, but you also don't want to get it, you know, don't want to fight with them. So that's an example of something that came directly from them and from their needs in their life.
Yeah. And once again, you can join the conversation and call 1-800-642-1234 if you have a question about PeaceWorks or something that has worked in your community in resolving behavioral issues. And Pam, I want to ask you as well, how do you know that PeaceWorks is working, that it's not something else in these alternative schools that is correcting student behavior?
I think there are a lot of factors. As I said, I think MPS is very committed to trauma-informed care and training their teachers in that paradigm and decreasing suspensions. But I think the feedback that we get from students, which is overwhelmingly positive, we do feedback surveys at the end of our time with them, and they give us such positive feedback in terms of how much they like the program and how much they've learned from it. We also do training with staff, and we conduct professional development, and we sit in on staff meetings and teach staff these same skills so that they can use them in the classroom, not only to teach students but also for themselves. And we get really positive feedback from staff and administrators as well. And one of the things that students will say over and over is they'll tell us, why isn't this program in all schools? You know, when we go back to our new school, we would love to be able to still do this. And so I think that kind of indicates to us that it is definitely a team effort, that the teachers and administrators in these behavior reassignment schools work so hard and are so dedicated to kids. And I think that's one reason that they value our program, is they see that we're all on the same page, and this is one way, an additional way to help them.
And Pam, if people want to read up on PeaceWorks, find out more information, or get some material, where should they go?
Yeah, they can go to the Center for Peacemaking website, which is at marquette.edu. And our contact information is there and all the information about our program. Marquette has been such a huge supporter of the center and of the program, and is just really committed to civic engagement. In fact, just won a major award this year, a national award for civic engagement. So they're really committed to helping PeaceWorks make a difference.
Pam, thanks for joining us. That was Pam Stoller. She's coordinator of the PeaceWorks program at Marquette University's Center for Peacemaking.